now open for the transaction of business. Draw nigh, all ye having business with this honorable court, and ye shall be heard. God save the state of Nebraska and this honorable court.
Thank you. You may be seated. And good morning to everyone. First of all, we will introduce ourselves. I'm Mike Havigan, the Chief Justice, and by seniority, we are going to turn to WebEx. Justice Miller Lerman.
Justice Miller Lerman, appearing by WebEx. Good morning.
William Castle.
Stephanie Stacy. Good morning.
Jeff Funk. Good morning.
Jonathan Papik.
And John Friedenberg.
Thank you all, counsel. Please, when you are not presenting this morning, keep your face masks on. When you are presenting, please take your face mask off so that we can hear and understand you. This, the first case of the morning, is In Re Interest of Ariana A. et al. Actually, we've got two cases, I believe, combined for oral arguments. Counsel, do you have any questions before we begin?
No.
Thank you very much. Mr. Catlett, good morning to you. You may approach and you may proceed.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please this court, my name is Matt Catlett. I represent the appellant in this matter, Joshua, we'll call him Joshua C. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal this morning. Your Honors, the parental preference principle or doctrine provides that a court may not deprive a natural or adoptive parent of custody of his or her child as against a non-parent, unless it is affirmatively shown that the parent is unfit or has forfeited his or her superior right to custody. This principle applies in juvenile court proceedings with the same force that it applies in county guardianship proceedings and district court child custody proceedings. In 2013, Stacy gave birth to Benjamin, and upon birth, Stacy and Joshua signed a notarized acknowledgement of paternity, acknowledging Joshua as Benjamin's father. This acknowledgement was filed with the Department of Health and Human Services pursuant to statute, Nebraska Revised Statute 43-1408.01, which requires the acknowledgement to be filed with the department at the same time that the certificate of live birth was filed. This court held in Caesar C. versus Alicia L. that a properly notarized acknowledgement of paternity, if not rescinded within the earlier of 60 days or the commencement of an administrative or judicial proceeding concerning the child, constitutes a legal finding or determination of paternity, which may only be set aside on the basis of fraud, duress, or material mistake of fact with the burden of proof on the challenger. Nebraska Revised Statute Section 71-612 requires the department to supply to any applicant with any proper purpose, as defined in the department's rules, a certified copy of any birth record. Obviously, this would include an acknowledgement of paternity and a birth certificate. In Kaiser versus Allen, this court in 1948 held that where a statute authorizes executive officers to make general rules for the conduct of public business, and such rules are duly made and published, the courts will take judicial notice of them. Title 174, Section 3-004.05 of the Nebraska Administrative Code provides that a proper purpose includes a law enforcement use, which means the use by a person charged by law with the duty of detecting or prosecuting crime or enforcing child support or establishing paternity, unquote. This establishes unequivocally that the state's executive branch, including all of its peace officers, either actually knew or were imputed with the knowledge that Joshua was the father of Benjamin 6 years before the peace officer named Jay Fryermuth even made contact with Stacy in October 2019. And of course, we also know from the evidence adduced at the hearings held in November and December of 2019 that the state knew that Joshua was Benjamin's father. The state, in its brief, variously keeps referring to Joshua as his putative father. He wasn't his putative father. He was his father. In 1993, the district court dissolved the marriage of William H. and Elizabeth W. and awarded custody to William, three daughters, visitation to Elizabeth. 8 years later, in 2001, the state filed a petition in the juvenile court in the interest of the three girls, alleging they were juveniles as defined under the code, on the basis that they lacked proper parental care due to the faults and habits of William. The state then filed a motion for ex parte temporary custody of the three girls, which was supported by an affidavit, and that motion was granted, subject, of course, to a detention hearing. At the detention hearing, William did not appear. Elizabeth did. It's not clear from the court's opinion and in re interest of Stephanie H., I think it's H., how Elizabeth even knew about it, but she was present, and a lawyer purporting to represent her said, well, I represent Elizabeth. She's the mother of these kids. We want custody. The court, well, I think what she actually said was it's our intent to apply to intervene. The court concluded the hearing by announcing that the temporary custody would remain with the department. Elizabeth's lawyer then asked the court if it would consider visitation, and the court said refused, saying it really didn't know anything about the situation, that Elizabeth was not named in the petition and had not intervened. 9 days later, upon the motion of Elizabeth for a detention review, I think that's how they characterized the motion in that case, in which she asked for custody of the three girls, the juvenile court held a hearing, at which hearing evidence was adduced by Elizabeth, among which evidence included a copy of the order of the district court that had dissolved the marriage, granting Elizabeth temporary custody. The juvenile court granted intervention to Elizabeth, but then denied her request for custody. Elizabeth appealed, the Nebraska Court of Appeals reversed. In so doing, the Court of Appeals stated, the juvenile court wrongly imposed the burden of proof upon the mother when neither the state nor the department had made any allegation whatsoever that the mother was unfit to have custody of her children or could not protect them from her ex-husband. Fundamental fairness demands that in a situation such as this, the mother be given prompt notice of any allegation against her which the state or the department contends make placement of her children with her contrary to the children's interests, and the burden of proof of such allegations is upon the state.
I'd like to move back just the parental preference issue you were talking about a little bit ago. I'm backing up on you a little bit. Now, if for the parental preference to actually apply, it requires the biological parent and some showing a developed relationship between that biological parent and the child prior to the claim being made, correct?
I guess I'm confused by the question.
Under the Supreme Court case that established that law, that preference, it's more than just a biological parent. It was a biological parent who had actually also shown a developed relationship with the child prior to the incident, correct?
You mean the original United States Supreme Court case or the case?
Yes.
I am actually not sure. I just know what the doctrine holds.
It's just assuming that is correct for the nature of this hypothetical. Your client actually had established a biological relationship with his child prior to this incident.
No
correct?
Question. I mean, no question.
A long-standing relationship.
No question about it. Now, as I'll get to here, it is our position that all this evidence that was adduced, you know, was really immaterial under In re Stephanie H.
I'm sorry, but the case that you're talking about, there was also an adjudication of custody. There was a custody order that came out of that dissolution, correct?
Literally the only difference.
It's a significant difference because in this case, is there an order establishing custody?
No, it's certainly not in your record. It's certainly not in the record. And I can also represent the answer is no. The Court of Appeals did not consider that important at all in its opinion. In fact, what they said was, in this case, due process requires notice of specific allegations against Elizabeth with proof thereof by the state. Both things are missing from this record. Although the Court of Appeals detailed the evidence adduced at the hearing on Elizabeth's motion and concluded that the juvenile court's order was not supported by the evidence, it did not actually need to do any of this in view of its holding that fundamental fairness and due process required notice of specific allegations against Elizabeth and its finding that there were none. In fact, at the very end of the opinion, the Court of Appeals stated, quote, "Our decision and directions, however, do not preclude the state from coming forward once the juvenile court reacquires jurisdiction of this cause upon receipt of our mandate with allegations and proof that Elizabeth is not a fit custodial parent of her children," unquote. The state here petitioned the juvenile court to adjudicate Benjamin and his three siblings on the basis that they lacked proper parental care due to the faults or habits of Stacy, their mother. It did not allege that they lacked proper parental care due to the faults or habits of Joshua. In fact, his name does not appear anywhere in the petition. It cannot be overstated.
If I may interrupt at this point, then, how did Joshua's fitness get into the case?
Well, we don't really know. I mean, we just filed a motion to intervene and for custody. And at the hearing on that...
It was a custody or temporary placement?
Well, I guess we view the words as being synonymous, placement of custody. I'm not sure what the motion actually said. Okay. It might just have said placement of Benjamin with Joshua.
Please continue with
how did that happen? It happened because we had a hearing and... I guess this is all part of the problem here, is that it's addressed in more detail in the brief, is that there was a problem in terms of not delivering Benjamin to Joshua. The state knew that he was the father, and for whatever reason, delivered one of the four kids to his father. It's hard to reconcile why the peace officer delivered one of the four kids to his father, but not the other three to their father. I just called Joshua to the stand.
Counsel, at the hearing, was the state focused on your client's asserted or claimed or speculated disability?
I'm not actually sure. It seemed that might be the case, but there was lots of other remarks about other matters. There was a kind of an undertone of that.
As Justice Castle just asked about, wasn't the state concerned that your client wouldn't be able, for example, to respond in the middle of the night if there was some kind of an emergency with the child?
Yeah, a manufactured concern.
I don't know why they were concerned.
I believe that is
a manufactured concern.
Well, it didn't have any actual evidence that Joshua was... incapable of providing proper care to his child. No actual evidence.
Let me ask this a little bit differently. Hasn't the state tried to come up with some way to place this child with your client?
No. We contend that the state has not. In fact, what the state even admits is that they were going to do so, but that it, quote, fell apart or, quote, deteriorated once the state learned that Joshua's mother was not living with him. Well, Joshua's mother was never living with him. She was just staying with him for a period of time. She was staying the night with him for a period of time after he had returned home from the rehabilitation clinic. So, yes, our contention is that these were manufactured concerns. They were not real concerns. Again,
I have a question. There seems to be something in the record that
Joshua's lawyer told Joshua not to communicate with folks from the Department of Health and Human Services. Is that accurate?
No. I cannot recall that specifically. That wouldn't have been accurate. I think the problem that Joshua was experiencing was that nothing was happening. And so he decided to hire a lawyer and file a motion with the juvenile court so that he wouldn't have to just go back and forth with this Joe Knott, the caseworker. Again, cooperation. I know that this term, cooperation, well, we need to have an honest and open conversation, and we need cooperation. Joshua had allowed these people into his home. He had answered their questions. There was already a, quote, plan. This is admitted by Mr. Knott at the hearing, that there was already this plan to do that. It's just that the plan somehow was conditional upon Joshua's mother living there. I don't understand any of this, but... I'm not even really sure what cooperation meant. It was just a made-up thing. So, to continue, the state here petitioned the juvenile court to adjudicate Benjamin and his three siblings on the basis they lack proper care to the false habits of Stacy. They did not allege that this was due to Josh. In fact, it cannot be overstated that even after Joshua filed his motion for leave to intervene and for temporary custody or placement of Benjamin, the state still did not amend or even seek leave to amend or supplement its petition to include an allegation as to Joshua. That first hearing was then recessed and continued to a month down the road. Still didn't happen.
Let me ask another similar kind of question. Is this something that could be handled by mediation?
I'm not sure what the statutes provide in terms of the authority of a juvenile court to order mediation in a pre-adjudication. I think the reason that Joshua did what he did was because it wasn't happening. You know, it wasn't happening. Placement of his child was not happening. I've completely run out of my time. I have
another question. Okay. Before you sit down. It's well established that the state has a parents patre responsibility to a child within their supervision. It's also a well-established rule that there is a liberty interest in a man or woman raising their child. Where is the balancing point between those two in a temporary placement decision?
Well, that's a... question that involves a very lengthy answer. There is a little bit of a conflict in cases, as has been noted in the brief. This court in interest of RG held for the first time the state need only prove by the preponderance of the evidence that an alleged neglected juvenile's custody should be in the state pending adjudication. There is a more recent case decided by the Court of Appeals in Ray interest of Jaden W., where the Nebraska Court of Appeals held that the standard was clear and convincing evidence. We believe that that is the correct standard, and we believe that the reason that the Court of Appeals ruled the way they did is because of decisions subsequent by this court, albeit not in the juvenile court context, but in the guardianship context, and the custody context, in re guardianship of KR, in re interest of Lakota Z, and Farnsworth v. Farnsworth. We believe that that law provides the appropriate balancing. I can't envision any reasonable justification for somehow differentiating a juvenile court proceeding with a guardianship proceeding and a district court custody proceeding. You're still talking about parent versus non-parent. There's no real reason for there to be a difference. So I am way out of time. Any other questions?
So, in the guardianship context and the custody context that you refer to, it's typically parent versus non-parent. But here, isn't the framework parent versus the state?
Right, but this court has previously held that the state essentially is the non-parent and that the parental preference principle applies in juvenile court proceedings. I'm not sure that the fact that this is what I just said. I don't understand how there's any distinction between the state versus, you know, grandma or, you know, uncle or cousin or
grandma foster. Doesn't have a parent's patriae right to enforce. The sovereign power of the state has to give way to constitutional limitations, but I don't think you can compare grandma to the sovereign state.
Well, it is as against a non-parent, right? I mean, that's what says the state is not a parent. Otherwise, then the parental preference principle doesn't apply in juvenile court proceedings. And would require this court to reverse all of the cases that holds that it does apply. So, anyway, any other questions, Your Honors? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ms. Messerschmidt, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Are you going to be sharing your time?
I am. I'll be taking 10 minutes, and Mr. Roberts will be taking 5.
And you're aware that you have to keep track of that 5 minutes. The bailiff will not.
Yep, I will do my best to keep track of that time.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Haley Messerschmidt. I'm a deputy county attorney with the Lancaster County Attorney's Office, and I represent Appellee State of Nebraska. As noted before, co-counsel Mr. Roberts will be taking 5 minutes, but I'll take 10 minutes. Today I ask the court to affirm the lower court, the juvenile court's orders regarding denial of placement of Benjamin with appellant, adjudicating the children, and overruling appellant's objection to proceeding on the juvenile court petition. To begin, I'd like to address the adjudication issue, that second appeal first. The juvenile court properly overruled appellant's objection to proceeding on the petition and allowed the mother to enter a plea pending to the pending petition without delay.
Is there any statutory authority for the juvenile court to maintain jurisdiction?
This court in Re Interest of Jedediah P. has said that the juvenile court is not always divested of jurisdiction. For example, interests of placement. I'm not aware of statutory authority, but the case law is clear. Juvenile court's not always divested of jurisdiction. In Re Interest of Joshua M., this court held that once an appeal is perfected, a trial court, such as the juvenile court, lacks jurisdiction to hear a case involving the matter between the same parties and the same, about the same matter between the same parties. Here, that same matter between the same parties is a key qualifier. We don't have the same parties involved in the first appeal regarding placement and the adjudication itself. Appellant was the one that filed the appeal. The mother did not engage in that appeal. Did not file any briefs, did not file an appeal. Her only participation was in the lower court hearing, being present and providing some testimony. The juvenile court petition was directed solely at her allegations as to her and did not address or affect appellant in any way.
Has any dispositional hearing occurred, or is just the adjudication?
Just the adjudication, at which time appellant appealed. We have not hit the dispositional phase, which brings up the point that parents' rights are really to be addressed at the dispositional phase, not the adjudication phase. The adjudication phase is focused on the children itself. Additionally, holding a parent hostage, essentially, by not allowing them to enter an adjudication and proceed with adjudication is ultimately what the result, if appellant's arguments are upheld, is what is resulting in that situation where the parent's not able to engage in rehabilitative plans and services, which becomes an issue, especially in a removal case when the children are out of home and that clock, 15 out of 22 months clock for termination, starts ticking away.
At the time of the adjudication, the state had still not asserted any claims against the father or assertions that the father was unfit or anything along those lines.
State had not filed any written petitions as to the father. At that point, father had appealed. State would contend, though, that allegations as to unfitness were raised during the hearings in November and December regarding placement.
That's your reliance for notice? Doesn't due process require both notice and hearing?
Due process does require notice.
So where's the notice?
Notice occurred during that hearing. So appellant filed a motion asking for placement of his child. In this court in Kiana T said a parent, a father, has to intervene and prove paternity. His acknowledgement of paternity was not offered until December 23rd, the second hearing in the case, showing that he actually was father and had a right to have that parental preference doctrine, so as well as participate in the juvenile court.
Was written notice given during the hearing?
Written notice was never given during the hearing.
Has written notice been given by the time of the adjudication?
No. Under Stephanie H., though, in re interest of Stephanie H., the court said notice is part of due process, but it doesn't actually specify that written notice is required. It's a flexible term. Due process is flexible based on the situation.
It's flexible enough to say in one breath, we think you're unfit, and in the second breath, proceed to put on evidence to that effect? Is that the state's position?
When the father came in asking for placement, the state's position is that until he had put that paternity, acknowledgement of paternity showing he was the father, if a parent or anybody comes in and asks for placement of a kid, alleging their placement or the father should have placement, or the mother in that case, but really the father's in a different position than the mother. It could be anybody coming in and saying, I want placement, and at that point it becomes an issue of...
I don't know if you heard Justice.
I did.
Why is a biological father in a different position than a biological mother?
Actually, there is no biological test or genetic testing in this case. He is...
Why is an acknowledged father in a different position than a biological mother?
Biological father or not legal parent, obviously when a child is born, it's pretty clear who that biological mother is through that birth process. This court has found in re interest of Kiana T that a father has to intervene and prove paternity.
Doesn't the state have notice by the acknowledgement? Isn't the acknowledgement filed in the records of the state? And the state knows exactly who the father is based on that acknowledgement.
The state, in a general sense, maybe, the county attorney's office...
In other words, as long as we don't smack you over the head, you don't have to go look? Is that what the state's argument is about this?
The typical process when it comes into our... A removal situation comes into our office from the county attorney's office is we do take a look at those certain situations or look for that information... But obviously our office is in a little bit of a different position. We don't have access to all of the records of this state. And some of that information is not always available or accessible by our office due to privacy issues.
Couldn't your office have proceeded against Joshua for child support based only on the acknowledgement?
Could have proceeded against him based on that. Based only on that. However, I don't believe... that had happened. I don't think there were any child custody or child support orders put in place for him, and that issue had not arisen. Our office typically gets involved in those cases when a child is receiving some sort of a state benefit, and so that kind of, again, puts it in a bit of a different position there.
Moving to a point where now the state is fully aware that the appellant exists and he's a parent, I'm going to ask the same question of you that I asked of your co-counsel. Where is the balancing point between the two legal theories of the parental preference in favor of the father and the state's parents' patria responsibilities for supervising the child while in the state's custody?
I think there definitely is a balancing aspect there. I know appellant argues that it should be a clear and convincing evidence standard. This court, though, has ruled it's a preponderance of the evidence standard in juvenile court cases. Under either standard, though, the unfitness allegations were raised. They were presented to the court, and the court did find a finding of unfitness. I think
if I may interrupt, so if fitness is in the case, how could you return to Justice Frydenberg's question? If fitness is in the case with respect to the father who's the legal father, what is the state to do? What would the state need to present to show unfitness so as to deprive the legal father of the enjoyment and responsibilities of his children?
Are you asking if fitness was found by the court or what needs to be done to show unfitness?
The latter, right. Fitness is now in the case. We have a legal father. What's the evidence that this father is unfit? Is it limited to his sequelae from Guillain-Barré? Is it that he never participated in their life? Is it because he's a dangerous person? Could you explain, in this case, an assessment of unfitness that is a proper consideration?
Yep. So fitness or unfitness that was presented at the trial court level involved domestic violence, physical abuse to the children, alcohol use and abuse, refusal to cooperate with the Department of Health and Human Services, as well as inability to perform basic parenting skills.
And the first time he heard about that was at the hearing.
Some of that, I mean, he would have been aware of some of that, you know, having had that background knowledge of being involved in a lot of those circumstances as well. Some of that, though, was not at first risen at the hearing. As appellant and some of the questioning earlier was asked, the department was working with him at some earlier in the case, and some of those issues as far as safety planning and other issues, his lack of cooperation with the department, those would have been more than likely addressed during communication between him and the department before communication obviously deteriorated. Domestic violence was threats to kill the mother himself as well as the children. A weapon was involved in that. Physical abuse involved one of the children saying they were choking themselves and saying that they were, if they didn't do it, appellant would have done it harder. Alcohol abuse was involved in all of that as well. And you had a foster parent saying he needed professional help parenting the children. It looks like I am running into Mr. Roberts' time. If there are no additional questions, I'd like to reserve or leave the remainder of the time for him and would just ask the court to affirm the lower court's jurisdictions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Roberts, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is C.J. Roberts. I'm an attorney for the Nebraska Department of Health and Human Services, one of the appellees in this matter. It is the department's position that the Separate Juvenile Court of Lancaster County did not err when it overruled overruled appellant's motion for placement change and found at that time that he was not a proper and fit parent for Benjamin.
Does the record show any more notice to the father than your co-counsel for the state has described?
Your Honor, I think that the issue from the department's standpoint is that this is a strange procedural because the department, I think the record indicates, was actively working with Mr. Colgrove to address concerns. I think Mr. Colgrove was well aware of what the department's concerns were. Mr. Colgrove filed a motion to intervene, which he should do and was properly done, but that motion also alleged in the same motion that he wanted placement at that time, and I think
filed prior to the time of the hearing.
Yes, appellant's motion was filed prior to the
long before the hearing.
Your Honor, I honestly don't know how long before it had been filed.
Matter of days, probably.
Well, help me. What were the department's concerns?
Your Honor, the department's concerns, and I think the concerns that came out on at the hearing on November 21st were that Mr. Colgrove's son was 6 years of age at the time. The appellant was suffering from the effects of Guillain-Barré syndrome. He was residing on his own. He wasn't able to prepare any of his own meals at the time. Home health aides were doing that. Once appellant was placed in his bed for the night, he was unable to get out of bed without the assistance of home health aides. I believe he testified that he didn't have any clothing for Benjamin other than socks at the home at that time. So I think clearly...
I beg your pardon. Is the sum of the evidence that that the father is unfit due to his disability?
No, I don't believe it's due to his disability. I believe it's due to his ability to provide the reasonable parental obligations due to a six-year-old child.
It seems to me you're saying that the concerns really revolve around the health of the father or the situation the father is in. He's got a disease situation where he can't, for example, get out of bed. The concerns the department had didn't have anything to do with domestic violence or any of the other things that suddenly came up at the hearing. Is that correct?
I believe those were concerns, but the department's, yes, correct. The department's major concerns were, was the appellant going to be able to safely care for Benjamin? Was it in his best interest at the time to be placed there? We believed that we could continue to work with the appellant to find people that could come in if home health aid was unable to show up, if there were circumstances in the middle of the night where assistance was needed. That was the plan we were trying to develop. At the close of the hearing on November 21st, the court, in fact, outlined a roadmap. Appellant took issue with that, but the department saw that as a roadmap for what needed to happen in order for placement to occur prior to or at the December 23rd hearing. But between the November 21st hearing, December 23rd hearing, all communication was cut off with the department. Appellant was apparently told not to have any contact with the department or its employees.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there a reason why there was not an amended petition filed after that November hearing and before the December hearing to outline the issues of unfitness by the father?
Your Honor, I don't know because as a department attorney, I'm not able to actually file that type of a petition against the father. So I guess my answer is that I don't know.
Now, BC has a half-sibling, DW, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And DW's father received placement.
Yes.
Is that correct? Did Health Human Services do any, did they go into DW's father's home or look into that situation at all before placement?
Your Honor, my understanding of the matter is that all occurred on an emergency removal with law enforcement. The fathers were contacted at the time. And I honestly don't know whether they would have gone into his home that night. They should have been going into his home very soon after.
Because Department of Health and Human Services just isn't a taxi service, are they? They don't take a child out of a bad situation and just go drop him off at the doorstep of an unknown?
No, that's absolutely not how it occurs. A worker who would be on call, it would be their job to come. Then they would be checking background check information. They should be going to the home. They should be discussing the issues with the parent. They should be walking through the home. That should be what occurs in every removal.
But you don't know if that happened with the DW's placement with his or her father?
I have to assume that it did, but I can't tell the court that I have personal knowledge of it.
Okay.
And I see that I'm also out of time, so the department would just also pray that the court sustain the separate juvenile court of Lancaster County's order, unless there are any further questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
We have no time for rebuttal. That concludes arguments then on 20-0009 and 20-0244. Counsel, thank you very much. Please keep your face masks on and properly social distance, and please leave by the side door to my left. Thank you very much.